We will call the House Committee on Judiciary to order February 1. I guess this is our first meeting of the year, the session of the new session that's going to run through June. Representative Barker, I'm not going to say anything that provides wisdom to you, or do you want to get on with it?
Let's get on with it.
Okay. Craig Pins, do you want to come up first or do you want Max up? Okay, Max, can you come up, please, and identify yourself?
Co-chairs, members of the committee, my name is Max Williams. I'm the director of the Oregon Department of Corrections, and hereby invitation of Mr. Taylor today to present some information that is a review of information that was done under Governor Kulongoski's reset report with respect particularly to public safety. Are you ready for me to proceed? Okay. And Enola was nice enough to bring up the presentation, and I'll hope that I push the right button to advance it. And I did.
You're already wrong.
Is it that one? All right. Perfect. Thank you. So this presentation, just to give you a little background, as you'll recall, Governor Kulongoski about a year and a half ago instituted a reset cabinet to take a look at the difficult challenges facing state government fiscally. And how those might be addressed in sort of laying a roadmap for what currently this legislature is going to have to address in the 11-13 budget cycle and beyond. That cabinet was a diverse group of people that covered a lot of areas, but it had four primary subcommittees that that focused on, and one of them was a public safety subcommittee, which the governor at that time asked me to chair. By way of background information, this just simply shows sort of the national trends that I think many of you are familiar with. Oregon is not alone. Virtually every state in the nation, as it's trying to grapple with this difficult financial circumstance, is trying to understand how to address corrections spending. You heard Governor Kitzhaber actually today in his budget announcement reference this very issue. This just shows you generally what's happened around the country. Prison population increased by more than 204%. State spending went up dramatically. Our budget in the Department of Corrections since 1989, sort of after we implemented sentencing guidelines to where we are today, has increased by 506%. And then obviously what we were all experiencing in 2010 with the total budget gaps for all the states, more than $192 billion. Because corrections is such an expensive part of state government, it's obviously gotten and garnered a lot of attention nationally. This next slide really talks about sort of the Oregon piece, and I don't need to remind you, this is a presentation that I've done to lots of groups and organizations around the state to try to help bring them into an understanding of how difficult the financial circumstances are that we're facing, but we're all aware of a $3.5 billion current service shortfall in the 11-13 biennium, and then to sort of explain to people that's really a 20% hole in the state's general fund budget. I point out just by way of example here that if you eliminated all the general fund for all the public safety agencies and the judicial department, you'd still be $700 million short in trying to fill this gap. So it just by way of example, I think, demonstrates the depth of this problem, and certainly also that it's not entirely solvable solely on the backs of the public safety portion of the budget, as again, I think all of you are certainly aware of. So the core functions that the governor's reset cabinet was intended to address, really, we spent some time talking about and looking at some data that had been collected by a variety of groups about what folks really wanted as a priority. Really, while in no particular order, I think it's safe to say that keeping the public safe in their homes and communities is certainly, I think, what most people expect government to do. The other issues, obviously, are equally important: protecting children, the disabled, and the elderly, helping families in crisis, preventing the cause and spread of disease, and the rest of these that are listed here, education beyond high school, educating children beyond high school, all parts, again, of, I think, the focus of what Governor Kitzhaber announced today. But these were the core functions that we were really focused on. Of course, when you talk about this, people regularly, as you've experienced as well, say if you would just focus on the core functions of government and get rid of all that stuff that isn't the core functions of government, we would have plenty of money. And I think this slide is really an educational slide, again, not for you, but for so many other people that we present this information to, that 93% of everything state government does currently is invested in those very core functions that we talked about. It's invested in education, human services, and public safety. Everything else is really a very, very small piece of the overall level of investment. But again, things that we would all agree, you're still going to have some amount of investment in natural resources and in transportation and other kinds of things that are equally important in civil society. So this, again, is just by way of background. State budget detail in 2009-11, gives you, again, just a snapshot of what that other 7% is, as I talked about. Natural resources, economic development, the legislative branch, money reserved in the emergency board. So you can't really balance a 20% hole in your general fund budget with only 7%, including functions that we would all agree have to be supported at some level. This gives you then a better slice of the pie. Again, I'm using 2009-11 numbers here, not the newly released numbers that were just part of the governor's budget announced today. But in 2009-11, this shows you a breakdown of how the public safety budget detail works. And you'll see that corrections is the, I used to say 900-pound gorilla, now I'll say the 67.2% gorilla in the public safety budget. It's the biggest piece of that. You can see DPSST, the district attorney's funds, the Department of Justice are relatively small in comparison to the money that we spend in community corrections for parole and post-prison supervision, state police and the youth authority as the other major drivers.
Max, you've got that 506% there, and one of your first slides, I should have got you then, but it was 600-some% at the national level. Was that time frame different, or did they actually have greater increases than we did in costs?
Co-Chair Krieger, I'd have to go back and probably look at the raw data that we got that from. Most of our data is comes from the Bureau of Justice Statistics, and I'm not sure if the time frames were exactly the same. But I think generally, if you talk to your counterparts in virtually any of the states, they would tell you that they've seen huge expense increases in corrections generally since 1989.
I'd at least like to know the part about the time frame, because
sure,
if it's not the equal time frame, that could throw the number off. But if it is equal, it would indicate ours didn't go up as much as some did.
Co-Chair Krieger, I would be surprised if there weren't other states that went up larger than we did for a variety of factors, whether or not the way their compensation system works is kind of further along in prices than ours are. And certainly other states made different choices. We certainly made choices in Oregon through the initiative process and legislative processes to increase the amounts of incarceration in a whole variety of crimes. Other states did similar things, and in fact in some cases hit a different category of crimes around drugs, for example, that dramatically increased under mandatory sentencing in drug crimes, that dramatically increased their populations. So I wouldn't be a bit surprised to see other states that actually had a larger increase than Oregon's. And again, the increase in and of itself is simply to demarcate how much growth there's been since 1989. It's really not a judgment of whether or not that growth was a good investment or a bad investment. It's simply just to say in the current environment where we're $3.5 billion short, the sustainability of that kind of growth in the long run is going to be very, very challenging for policymakers to.
It would be interesting to see what do we do for K-12 during that time and other
right.
things that we value higher ed. Okay, thank you.
You bet. So again, I would just make the final bullet point here is this budget growth has been driven not solely by just the sentencing policy issues, but also by increases in the general cost of government, which includes primarily for the Department of Corrections, because we're a people business, the cost associated with personnel. The more people we've decided to incarcerate, the larger number of prisons that we've had to build, the more staff that we've had to hire, and the organization is probably more than doubled in size
in the last 15 years as a result of those increases. And that's just a function of the operational impacts of the policy choices that have been made. You're all familiar, I think, and you've seen this picture before. Again, this is a little dated data, but it came out of the December 2010 revenue forecast showing where revenues were expected to go over the decade versus expenditures. And this is this sort of decade of deficits that Governor Kulongoski talked quite a bit about, suggesting that if we don't really make changes, I think the kinds of changes, for example, that Governor Kitzhaber spoke about even in his budget announcements today, we never get to a point where our revenues and our expenditures are going to match up. So these are the hard choices that we're facing organizationally. And I think it's fair to say that the reset report made this point. It's not just a revenue problem. As the economy recovers, our revenue is actually going to grow, but our expenses are going to exceed our revenues dramatically if we don't make certain policy changes in the future. So we have both a spending, a structure, and a prioritization problem moving forward, and I think that was the conclusion that the reset cabinet made in its report to Governor Kulongoski. So there were lots of different recommendations that were made in this report, recognizing the short period of time and the inability to do high levels of in-depth work on a lot of these policy conversations. I think what you got out of the reset report was a whole series of recommendations and examples of strategies that bear further exploration. Obviously, the reset cabinet didn't have the authority to change state statute or even in many cases it could make recommendations about policy changes but not implement those. So what you have in the reset report is really a series of recommended places to explore if one wanted to approach how you would try to deal with this $3.5 billion shortfall. The four subcommittees, as I mentioned, K-12, higher ed, human services, and public safety, each in addition to the reset cabinet report, opined essentially an appendix or a separate report associated with them that had a greater amount of detail in it. And then, of course, the full cabinet made statewide recommendations regarding issues, primarily compensation benefits for both state and K-12 employees that were not in any of the specific reports, but because they really were a statewide issue. So,
Mr. Chair. Director Williams, Has Governor Kitzhaber made a comment about the reset recommendations and whether he adopted them or he's going to pursue the reset committee's recommendations and agree to their core functions, or is there any?
Co-chairs, Representative Wisnett, I think the specifics of which, if any, of those recommendations are going to be adopted, really I think it's going to take some time to probably look at his budget specifically to see which ones may or may not have been included. And I have to say that I haven't had the opportunity to do that. I think generally he's acknowledged, and I think even acknowledged prior to his inauguration, that these were issues that he was planning to consider. So I would expect that we'll continue to have these conversations, because I think it's a fairly limiting place to go. I think his comments even this morning, and I haven't had a chance to look at them in detail, but about some of the initiatives associated with school consolidation and others are consistent with the kinds of things that were being talked about in the reset report.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So, as you remember, some of the statewide initiatives that were referenced in this report were labor cost issues associated with the program for all of state government management and labor both, tying these things more to a private sector organizational and efficiency approaches, following up on the efforts that I think many in state government have made to use lean initiative strategies. There was recommendations around revenue stability and kicker reform and to essentially adopt the prior recommendations that the revenue stability group that Governor Kulongoski had organized had recommended, and then to also look differently, and I think again this is borne out in some of the information that was even shared today, looking differently at the way state and local partnerships work, focusing on figuring out new and better structures for how we do business. Everything from consolidation to asking ourselves whether or not our current model of how we break things down and delivering services sort of in county sort of structures could be done differently, whether through intergovernmental agreements or shared services or shared resources. And I think, again, those were identified as areas to consider from a statewide initiative rate. Now, Mr. Prinz will share more information with you about this when he presents, but I think as we move into the public safety side of the conversation specifically, you'll see that we are at a very, I think, tremendous place in Oregon right now to be able to have conversations about these subjects. We've seen a drop in both violent crime and property crime in Oregon. This obviously reflects the violent crime rates between 2008 and 2009, but more importantly, I think it points out that we're at the lowest rate of violent crime since the data was beginning to be collected by the FBI in 1969. And you can see between 2004 and 2009, a violent crime rate drop of 15%, which is a large one compared to virtually all the other states.
Max, we see the drop. We know that's good. Less victims. There was a cost with Measure 11 and other, you know, choices the state made. Is there anything that shows us how much we saved? In other words, there were savings to the public, there were savings to the state, and there was less retrials, people in and out the doors. At one time, I'd heard it cost $58,000 to arrest and run a person through the system to get them back in the prison that you let them out of. I wondered if you had any information anywhere on that.
Co-Chair Krieger, I think probably the best person to talk about that and to talk a little bit about how you do the cost-benefit analysis on these very important public safety policy issues is going to be covered in Mr. Prinz's presentation. I think he can talk a little bit about actually some of the very innovative tools that they have right now to be able to plug in some of this data and get a better sense of what do you expect for choices you make about both how it affects crime rate and then what it does to your potential public safety savings. And they can share, I think, that information with you during their presentation. The good news, I think, however, is to really acknowledge the efforts of the public safety folks across the board, from police on the street, you know, the benefits of community policing, all of the strategies that we've used as a state to try to really address crime, and we've seen some, I think, some tremendous results through the management of the issues at the jails, through the prison system, through our efforts in investment in reentry and transition, to our efforts to try to address one of the great drivers of crime in Oregon, which is addiction, and our efforts to try to address things through addiction treatment and programming. So those are all part of it. I think we also have to acknowledge, if we're being honest about the data, that as much as you know, I would love to claim credit for this massive, because you'll remember that I was appointed in 2004. So I'd love to take credit for all of these reductions in crime across the state. I think we also have to acknowledge that around the country, there has been generally a reduction in crime nationally. And so while some of it are certainly driven by policy choices and some of it are driven by investments, I think we also have to acknowledge that some of this is likely driven by broader demographics as well, by changes in the overall age of people within the crime-committing cohorts that are also playing out in these statistical models. So I think anybody who comes in and wants to sort of seize all the victory for these numbers for any particular policy or issue, whether it's reentry and more alcohol and drug treatment, or whether it's increased levels of incarceration, you should be suspicious of that. I think all of it plays a part. I don't think anybody can lay claim to all of the rationale behind why these happen, because I think some of them happen just because the population is changing, and there are economic and other factors that may be at play. And if you really want an interesting conversation that's a lot like sitting in a room with a bunch of on-the-other-hand type economists, get a group of criminologists in a room and ask them what drives crime rates. And, you know, you'll spend weeks and not come out probably any clearer because it's a matter of a great debate, I think, in the field. Oregon's property crime rate also was larger than the national rates. Again, we're at the lowest property crime rate in Oregon in this last round, as this document was prepared of FBI data, since 1966. And it's obviously the first time that we've been below the U.S. average since we've been comparing the data since 1960. So again, I think there is some clear drivers on this one. And I would, you know, again, not claiming total victory for the approach here, but we went through a massive increase in property crime. I think almost everyone would agree, driven by the meth epidemic tied to the legislature's decision to increase penalties for identity theft tied very closely to meth, and we watched sort of how that spilled over throughout the entire criminal justice system. And I think that the policy choice that Governor Kulongoski and the legislature made to put the methamphetamine drugs behind the counter and require a prescription, which is now being modeled in numerous other states, is a great example of a policy intervention that was not an expensive public policy intervention from the standpoint of building more prisons or expanding the total number of prosecutors or police, that I really do think played out in a very significant way in impacting property crime in Oregon. Now, again, it's difficult to strip out which particular policy is the primary driver of this, but I don't think any of the groups or organizations would disagree that that's had an impact overall on our property crime rates, at least at some point. So this little thing is just a piece that I use, and I've shared this with several of you just to describe, particularly because corrections is often referred to as sort of the black hole in the public safety budget, to talk a little bit about what goes into that black hole and what makes it so challenging to deal with. And I think, again, as you see and you look at this box, you'll see that it's sort of hemmed in on multiple sides. I referred to it in a conversation earlier today a little bit like the Gordian knot. It's very difficult to change. On the one hand, we've got sentencing policy constraints mandated. There is no release authority within the Department of Corrections like some jail, like sheriffs have for certain crime categories. Any changes to those policies require two-thirds votes of the legislature, so you've got this additional supermajority challenge, and you've got some constitutional limitations that even if you want to change things and you get those two-thirds votes, it requires that you go back to the actual courts of conviction and have things change. So that's the one side that makes it, I think, difficult when people want to bring forward a list of sentencing policy options, and that creates. On the other side, you've got the labor constraints, and obviously, and those are just not, again, when I say labor, I mean all labor, from me as the director all the way through the system. You have these challenges with respect to public employee collective bargaining agreements that we're obligated to enforce and operate with. We've got Senate Bill 400, which is was passed in 2007, that requires bargaining on particular safety issues. There are statutory limitations and the like that limit how far you go on that side of the box. Underneath it, obviously, constitutional and statutory constraints. The Eighth Amendment of the United States Constitution dictating that there will be no cruel and unusual punishment, as interpreted by the federal courts, relates to everything from the level of health care that we provide to very specific conditions of confinement that limit your ability to do much on that front. And then, obviously, the physical constraints on top, driven, again, often by things like, for example, ballot measures that aren't necessarily funded into the base of the thing, and other kinds of adjustments, PERS rates and other things that I mentioned in that box. So that's what makes it, I think, sometimes so hard to maneuver inside the corrections budget, and poses both a challenge, I think, for me, for the governor in building a budget, and then obviously for the legislature to figure out, you know, how can you do things differently with respect to corrections, which is such the lion's share of public safety. Now, we came up with a variety of options in the public safety reset cabinet. Again, these were options that were put forward as really for conversation moving forward into the legislative session in the future about things that a state might do. And we looked at what many other states were doing around the country. So if you look at that report, you'll see quite a section that compares us to other states like Kentucky and Texas and Kansas and other states that have also been trying to address this problem and some of their approaches. The first of this was to actually change the model. We have a system right now that operates with really kind of a over time piece together approach to how we do sentencing, primarily driven through the biggest piece through the initiative process, obviously. And so this would be a recommendation to go back to a modern sentencing guideline approach that creates additional judicial discretion in exercising the use over this 14,000 bed prison system that's now been built. As it points out here, since 1989, we've added an additional 9,000 beds to the system. So what existed as a sentencing guideline system in 1989 and it was essentially overcome by Measure 11 in the ballot initiative process. Since then, we've added 9,000 beds. So your overall resource to incarcerate is substantially larger than it was then, meaning that your guidelines model could be very different than it looked in 1989. So that was one of the options that was discussed. Another option that was put forward was to look at the federal earn time model for corrections. Right now in corrections, if you're in a non-mandatory sentence, a non-Measure 11 person crime sentence, you're entitled, if you meet the qualifications and you behave appropriately and you program appropriately, up to 20% earn time on those limited sentences. The federal model is a 15% system. So you might be wondering, well, how does that save you any money if you've got currently a 20% system and you want to go to a 15% system? How the federal model is different, though, is they don't limit, except for treason and murder, sort of life sentences in the federal system. They don't limit who actually gets it. So you'd be applying a lower amount of earn time, but to a broader group of offenders in the system. And then the use of both electronic monitoring and a halfway house system in the final year of the sentence allows you to technically move, or theoretically at least, move people out of your expensive incarceration beds into a less expensive local model for that final year of transition, or some portion of it, as they move out into the community. And that's currently how the feds primarily operate their system. Now, obviously, you got to be in the right category of offense. You got to have the right kind of behavior. They're not just exiting everybody out the door in their final year. People who can't behave appropriately, they're going to stay in until the very end. But they do have a category of offender that they manage during that final year of incarceration in a halfway house type model that aids in their incarceration and theoretically lowers their overall per bed cost. Another issue that was laid out in the report were selective adjustments to the Measure 11 sentences, looking at specific major drivers in the Measure 11 sentence and seeing if you made adjustments to certain portions of those, not a full-on repeal of Measure 11, but adjustments to certain segments of those, whether or not those adjustments would produce sufficient savings to at least have a conversation about what that would look like, and then to talk about, secondly, what the public safety effect of reducing some of those particular sentences are. So that was identified in the report, and there were assessments done on that. Obviously, in the last legislative session, as part of the legislature's effort to balance the budget moving forward, there was the decision made for a limited suspension of ballot Measure 57. So if Measure 57 comes back on, we would expect to see the impact of Measure 57 coming back on start to affect the overall prison population moving forward, about like it was estimated to in the future. And our current forecast models reflect the actual application of what happened with Measure 57. So not the previous estimates that were done with no data, but actually capturing how it was applied and then trying to apply that going forward into the future. That will cause an increase in overall population, will cause us to probably have to have a conversation about future prison construction. And so one of the alternatives that was put forward here is what would be the impact on the overall prison population if the legislature decided to continue the suspension of Measure 57. So that's been identified.
Mr. Chair. Thank you. Director Williams, I thought we had, when we first came out with 57, we had a period it was enforced until the election was over, and I thought that it was a lot less than we thought it was going to be for 57.
Co-chairs and Representative Wisnett, I think that there was an early assessment done based on how they believed it was going to be applied. Then we had a period where it was actually applied, and those numbers and data were captured, and they were less than what the previous assessment was. The going forward estimates of what we think the impact will be in the future are based on what it looked like during the period that it was actually applied. So as you're looking at a current prison population forecast as it moves forward, and it assumes, because it has to be a current law forecast, it assumes that Measure 57 will come back online. The forecast projections done by the department, by DAS, Office of Economic Analysis, they've used the data associated with the actual application of that period of time for Measure 57 in building their forecast going forward. Again, it's quite dependent on how it gets applied on a county-by-county basis. So all they can do is really look at the current data that they've had during that short period of time that it was in place, and then try to draw some assumptions about how that would play out if it came back in line and then was fully implemented.
So follow-up, Mr. Chair. So you're back to your slide. You're saying you're asking for another suspension in this session. Is that?
Co-chairs and Representative Wisnant, I'm really here to report on the issues that were laid out in the reset cabinet report for purposes of review. I'm not here with any authorization from Governor Kitzhaber to say we think this is a good idea and that's a good idea. I'm really here to give you an overview of what the reset cabinet for Governor Kulongoski put forward as options or alternatives to be considered as you figure out how to struggle with the $3.5 billion shortfall you're going to be dealing with in this session.
One other question, Max, not really along that line, but how much effect is there on how the district attorneys decide to charge? In other words, they can drive that up or down.
Co-Chair Krieger, you're absolutely right. I mean, there is great discretion at the local level in not even just with the district attorney, which obviously exercises a large amount of discretion about how to charge up these sentences, but there's great discretion even among the law enforcement community locally about who they want to target. And we see that impact throughout the system at times when a particular issue becomes a concern for a community and everybody decides we're going to really put a big focus on this one issue and we're going to treat it a little more harshly and we're going to put more people on the street, grabbing people who are engaging in this behavior. We are sort of the caboose on that, on those choices. It's after they've been arrested, they've been charged, they've gone through the process that they ultimately land in the department. So there is that discretion that operates on the front end of the system that can drive it. And if they choose to charge it up differently than they previously charged, you're going to have a different outcome at the end of the day than what was predicted.
Okay, Representative Garrett, you have a question?
Yeah, I just wanted to ask, maybe now is not the moment, but at some point, would you talk about the impact of Measure 73 on all of this?
Co-chairs, Representative Garrett, I will. And I think I've got a slide that at least talks about that coming out.
And I actually think the co-chair kind of hit a large part of this situation on the head with the way mandatory minimum sentencing, I would submit, really works, which is that indeed, I mean, if I were to take this pencil and stab Schaffler in the hand with it, that's good for 70 months under Measure 11 without earning
time. A bloody nose, too.
Not necessarily.
Not if I shoot you first.
That'd be Assault 4, which is 163 to 160. But this would be 163, 175, Assault 2, okay, unless, and that is if he takes it to trial and loses, that is what the judge has to give him. So it does in that way constrain the judicial, with discretion. But the reality of it is that all it really does is shift the decision of how much time the person gets back down the chain to the prosecutor, frankly. I mean, mandatory minimum sentencing, I don't think people realize it so much, but it should be part of a discussion, really doesn't sort of eliminate the decision. It just shifts who makes it. Okay, it eliminates the decision for the judges, ultimately, but ultimately, it means the prosecutors and the district attorneys do have a lot more discretion and a lot more power. And so what I could do is say that, well, maybe the injury isn't so bad, and this is where the discretion all comes in, and maybe he's eligible for the escape hatch, which is part of Measure 11. I think it's 137.712, right? And so now what was 70 months with no good time gets reduced automatically to, say, 34 to 36 months with 20% and alternative program eligibility.
Right.
See? And so this should all go into the thinking, because how much money does that save? Right, and indeed. Also, the way I think prosecutors are charging cases lately, certainly with the county budget situation being what it is, for better or worse, and it's bad, I think, almost everywhere you go, is that, under the presumptive guidelines, meth, or take identity theft, for example, over a non-repeat offender, is about 10 days, typically, right? And so, if we charge under Measure 57, or OS 137.717, which is the repeat property offense, right? It can go up to 13 months. Well, 10 days is basically nothing in a county jail. In Josephine County, it's 0 days. Okay, so the discretion, so prosecutor's decision is basically you give them zero time or 13 months. And by the way, if it's 13 months, you can send the bill to the state who's got the deep pockets, which everybody knows. So I know this is probably not the right place to point this out, but I hope this is part of the ongoing discussion when we start talking about what mandatory minimum sentencing really is and the real implications of it. So,
and,
so I think the chair did hit it on the head.
Yeah, co-chairs and Representative Hicks, I appreciate your insight because you're absolutely right. There is a great amount of discretion, and prosecutors exercise and have judiciously, in many cases, exercised that discretion, I think, as compared to what the original estimates were when everyone sort of assumed a straight-line implementation of ballot measure 11. I mean, those early estimates, because no one had any experience with it, sort of assumed way back in the mid-90s that everybody would get the maximum sentence because that's sort of what the ballot measure suggested, that there would be sort of a uniformity in application, that if you did this particular act, you were going to serve a mandatory sentence and everybody knew it. That's not actually what's happened. It upped the price of the plea negotiation because you've got the hammer of the mandatory sentence, but oftentimes there's something less than that mandatory sentence that ultimately is pled out. And I think it's important to understand that's when we talk about particularly the growth in the Department of Corrections budget. You've got the direct impact of Measure 11 driven by those who actually go to trial and get a Measure 11 sentence. You've got the indirect impact of Measure 11, which is really driven by the plea negotiation that Representative Hicks referenced that actually still, in many cases, increased the amount of time that a person was going to serve in prison prior to a Measure 11 passage. But is less than a Measure 11 sentence, but still impacts by a longer length of stay and an impact on bad or, as in the situation he described with the property crime case, having people end up in the Department of Corrections as opposed to a jail sentence under some of the property crime statutes that both through the ballot and the legislative process have been enacted. So it is. They are all intermingled in this conversation, and I think it's appropriate to talk about what those impacts have been and how that plays out. Is you want to start having a conversation about sentencing policy. The people who actually are in the position to make those charging decisions and then work through that process have a great power in affecting what the ultimate impact of the system is going to be. And I think that's a point that I doubt anyone would disagree with. The other two points, obviously, on this page, just other things that were put forward. Enhancing the home detention model, for example, looking at ways to actually convince folks that instead of maybe sending somebody into the prison system, maybe there's a way to manage them less expensively at the community level without trading public safety off in the process, by using some additional supervisory authority and enhancing electronic monitoring, which is being talked about, again, all over the country. And then there were some discussions that were what I would suggest were sort of out-of-the-box conversations. They've drawn a lot of criticism, obviously, in part because Cabinet didn't have the level of time or the ability to pull all the right people together to really break these out. But there were conversations about, and I'll give you an example, in community corrections, when someone's successful in community corrections and we actually see a reduction in recidivism in a county operating community corrections, meaning that they're doing good things and they have fewer people ending up on their supervisory caseload, we reward them by continuing to cut their budget. And so you actually sort of have a disincentive at some level for counties to move people off of the supervisory model, because when you take them off the supervision, we quit paying for them. And so there's a reason to want to keep people being supervised from an economic standpoint. This concept, by the way, isn't limited just to public safety. It's sort of interwoven in virtually almost every avenue where the state partners with the counties in some level. And so for purposes of thinking about these issues, it's really asking yourself the question, is there a way where you can actually reward good performance with your local partner? If they're doing the right things, you actually find a way not to strip them of all their resources, but actually enhance their resources that are producing the proven results. And I think that was one of the issues. Again, provide incentives for counties to expand local control to 24 months. Right now, local control is 12 months. If it's 12 months in a day, you come to the Department of Corrections. If it's 12 months or less, you stay under the county local control model. Well, is there a way, and would it make sense, for example, to have an approach that would allow, again, local supervisors authority up to 24 months with the right financial support for the counties to allow them to maintain supervision of that group of offenders and divert them from a prison bed. Whether or not that economically works out, I think we still have to unpack a lot of those numbers, but it's the kind of thinking I think, frankly, as we move forward, we're going to have to talk about as we reevaluate this system of public safety, which really can't be run as a local community, a county, and a state system independently, but we have to work at sort of
making this a harmonious system where we really are leveraging and utilizing all of our best efforts. The third point gets back to the point that Representative Hicks made, which are there incentives for counties that adopt a different approach to statewide practices. I think if you were looking at the data right now, you'd see that counties have a very different set of charging practices for particular kinds of crimes. In Representative Hicks County, stabbing Representative Schaffler with a pencil, that might actually get charged up as a Measure 11 offense and move forward. In another county, I won't say the person will be rewarded, but they might not get a Measure 11 offense for stabbing Representative Schaffler with a pencil. There's inconsistency in how counties use the state resource of incarceration. And so the question is then, is it worth the conversation to talk about incentivizing counties who want to agree to use that resource in a more uniform and predictable way that's similar across the state as opposed to be so different on a county-by-county basis? Again, not well fleshed out in the report, but identified as a place where there may be some avenue for conversation over time.
Bill, do you have a question?
Sure. Commissioner Williams, could you explain to the committee how local control works? I mean, it doesn't mean they're sitting in the jail for the whole period of time, does it?
Co-chairs and Council Taylor, no. Typically what happens in a local control case, and in some cases they may be in the jail for some period of time, but they're essentially funded at a certain level for a local control offender who meets that criteria under what was then Senate Bill 1145 that created this, the Community Corrections Act. But the local county has supervisory authority over that individual, which means that they make an assessment at some point about whether that individual should stay in a valuable and expensive jail bed, or whether they could potentially manage that offender more effectively in the community with enhanced supervision, with a parole and probation officer, and in a with day reporting or some other strategy. And so the notion would be that with any kind of expansion of that local supervisory authority, is you give the county the ability and the discretion to sort of move between the jail bed and a community supervision, with always, I think, for it to be successful, the threat that if that person blows it, you've got the sanctionable ability to pull them back into jail. If this system doesn't work, if counties don't have jail beds, if you don't have a funded jail bed that you can pull somebody back into for a sanction, then really all you're doing is you're just letting people out of jail who probably should be in jail. But if you can mirror it with some sort of a structured sanction, and you've got the ability when you need to pull somebody back in for a jail sanction, you've got the ability to sort of extend your resources and not necessarily do any damage holistically to public safety. And I want to make a point about that while I've got your attention on this point. We are going to talk about this year, because we won't have any alternative, changes to public safety in sort of global sorts of ways. If you change these sentencing practices, here's what might happen predictably. You might have some decrease in this or some increase in that. And I think it is important that we stay and try to stay focused on the data. Individually, I'm not going to be able to tell you as we talk about potential alternatives. And at some point, and I can almost guarantee it will happen, I'll be in here testifying about some piece of legislation that someone has put forward that may be cutting time off an individual's sentence early, releasing them from prison early, or diverting them from prison. And I'm not going to be able to sit here and tell you that every one of those people are going to be successful, or that one of them won't go out and do some horrible thing that after the fact, when it's on the front page of the newspaper, we'll all have some concerns about. Globally, no one can make those kind of commitments. So when we talk about these impacts, I think we have to remember that we're talking about them sort of from a global perspective. In the individual cases, even when I give you all the best data I've got about who my low-risk inmates are, who the people we think we could manage safely in the community, this is not an exact science. We cannot predict with absolute certainty public behavior. But we make those kinds of choices all the time in our public safety system about how we manage that risk. And it's an imperfect science. And sometimes we're wrong about it. And bad things happen when we're wrong about it. And usually there is a strong political reaction when a bad thing happens. And if we're really going to have this conversation seriously in a meaningful way moving forward, we have to, I think, acknowledge that issue up front, acknowledge that there's risk associated with these conversations, and then do the very best job we can to try to identify the smartest approach we can take as we analyze this data, recognizing that these are difficult, difficult decisions, and that there is none of them that are risk-free as we implement them. So I appreciate you letting me make that point. This page, really, we made some very rough estimates, again, working with a lot of different folks to try to guesstimate over a decade what some of these impacts might do generally to the public safety budget. There aren't any or very few short-term solutions that produce serious money on sentencing policy changes. Sentencing policy is a long thing. It takes the investment to get into it, and it takes a long time to change things so you get your investment back out of it. But this gives you a range of ideas of what would happen. So a continuing suspension of Measure 57, for example, is estimated between $121 to $260 million over the decade. Those modeled modifications, and I'm not going to give you all the detail, they're in the report, but it showed a range of between $60 to $127 million. And then again, depending on how you implement the earned time model, because if you don't have those, if you don't have those beds for halfway houses and other things, that model doesn't really save you very much money. But if you were to do it over time, there's a range, obviously, depending on how who it's applied to and how it works, that's fairly substantial. So that gives you some sense of the ranges. And again, we also tried to range the effects between our very less expensive temporary beds, which we're operating a bunch of now in the department, where we've kept beds closed for staffing reasons, and we've tipped up beds in other places that are less expensive beds. So those would be the first beds to go. So those aren't your most expensive beds. Those are your less expensive beds. Eventually, you get into your more expensive beds where you can actually start talking about, do we need all the prisons we've got, et cetera, and that's where more of the savings is identified. Here's the slide, Representative Garrett, on Measure 73. You all remember Measure 73 had a couple of different components to it. One was related to felony sex crimes the two major felony sex crimes impact. The second one related to the DUI convictions, the third in 10 years to carry a minimum of 90 days. And a presumptive prison sentence, and this is really, and you probably all heard more about this than you wanted to, but because of the way the statute works, this offense, given the way it's written, even though it says 90 days, moves people into a category of presumptive prison. And so that's sort of driven then on the impact. So as you look at the impact, there were groups pulled together. Obviously, the second offense, sex crimes, very few offenders impacted. Typically, people who got convicted for their first sex offense, Measure 11, are going to be serving a long time in prison. So at that point, you assume they're out, they committed a second one. So they're going to serve long, and then they're going to get this enhanced penalty at the end. So it takes a long time before that starts to have a lot of impact on the department from a bed standpoint. The DUII conviction piece obviously moves much quicker in its impact. There were a lot of conversations, obviously, but estimates that were provided about how it might be applied suggest somewhere between 250 to 330 beds, depending on whose estimates you want to use, whether it's going to be applied like it is now or applied as folks have suggested that they might apply it, and that gives you some estimate. And then obviously by 15-17, it grows even larger. This is the range. Again, these numbers came from the price tag committee assessment that was done on Measure 73 as the ballot measure went out. You can see sort of two categories. Measure 73 did something that no other measure currently in Oregon law does, and that requires the state to be on the hook for all pretrial and post-conviction expense for the county associated with that measure for incarceration. So currently right now people are arrested, they're held at the local level pending conviction. At the time of conviction, they get sent to the Department of Corrections to our custody, and we're on the hook for that. What this measure does for these DUII offenders specifically, it says that essentially from the period of arrest in the county jail through the time of trial, and any time if it's less than an amount that they would serve with the Department of Corrections, but they serve that time locally, the state pays the counties for that incarceration. And it pays, I think it refers to, I think it says actual costs in the actual measure. So there's a lot of uncertainty both about the implementation of that piece and whether or not that's sort of like the state's going to receive a kind of almost like when you check out of a hotel a bill that says, you know, so many meals and, you know, so many rolls of toilet paper and all of that, or if it's going to be done in a process where we identify through the legislative rulemaking and agency rulemaking that there's a sort of flat per-day rate like we do currently with the local control offenders.
Max, back just one. You don't have to go back, but you talked about the money saved. Did you were the costs of reincarceration in there? And the other part of that is if people get an early out, the conditions to which they enter today with the unemployment where it is and the lack of job opportunities, one of the, you know, jobs and a place to live is the two main things, you know, the environment that people are in.
Right.
Is recidivism, you think, going to be higher from those people that get out during those economic times, which means we're going to drive up costs?
Co-chair Krieger, I think we, again, recognizing that the analysis that was done in the reset cabinet was, you know, we used the best data that we had. We typically, I think, assumed in all of those programs, particularly any that would sort of put people in a community corrections supervision kind of a model as opposed to a prison bed, we used the best data we had to assume a certain level of failure rate in reincarceration. Typically in these models, we attempt to look at what's currently happening with any kind of a program that's similar, and you make an assessment about what you think the failure rate's going to be, and you build that in and say, okay, we're going to, because people will fail, there's no question about it, and then you factor that in and say, even with the failure rate or even with the shift in the dollars, some will save money in prison beds, but it will increase the amount of spending we're going to have to do in community corrections, and you're really capturing the savings on the difference between those. We did try to incorporate those and make those as sophisticated as we could in the time frame we had, but I will tell you, they are estimates, and they are estimates of a potential decade of effects that will have thousands of other factors that would potentially play on it. So I think it gives you a sort of a range of what your savings might be, but I don't know that anybody would want to sort of feel locked in that they were committed that they were going to produce those numbers, particularly without a lot further investigation. Your second question, as it relates to what, you know, recidivism is a lagging indicator. You know, we are looking at recidivism rates right now in our most recently reported cohort that are actually quite positive. They're trending in a positive way. We're actually a little below, in a positive way, the statewide benchmark and our key performance measure on recidivism. But we're talking about people who were released essentially 3 years ago and following them for the 3 years that they've been out and tracking their reconviction of a felony during that period of time. So that's positive. But again, recognizing we're talking about what was going on 3 years from now or 3 years ago when they released till now is sort of what's being measured. I think it's yet to be determined what recidivism is going to look like and whether or not the economic circumstances, as you point out, where people have been having a much more difficult time finding work. Our population that we release out, as everybody looks for work, it sort of forces those with a felony conviction further down the chain. So, you know, when they used to maybe show up at a labor-ready operation and find day labor, you got people there now who don't have a felony conviction. They're kind of being shoved out of even those kinds of opportunities. I would guess that we will see some impact on recidivism as a result of that. I can't guarantee it, but my gut tells me that as people continue to struggle for work, and it's a tremendous protective factor when you have employment from reoffending, that it will have some impact. But we have tried to consider generally those factors in this analysis. But again, this was all done by way of creating a whole series of things to talk about more in depth once a legislature came together. You'll also recall, and I think I comment on this, I don't know if I comment on it here or in another presentation, but the governor also in the reset cabinet and in the second installment of that recommended the creation of a public safety commission. He created that commission by executive order right before the end, Governor Kulongoski, right before the end of his term. I believe it's Governor Kitzhaber's intent to continue with that executive order. It has the representatives of the legislative branch, the leadership of the legislative branch, the executive branch, and the judiciary in that commission to sort of carry on. I don't think, frankly, the short term, what are we going to do in this immediate biennium budget problem, but to really look at this with this 10-year perspective of how do we do what we want to do with respect to policy around public safety that's going to both keep the public safe and really make sure that we're maximizing the public's resources. The do-nothing to the operational budget, we're projected right now without any policy changes to add about another 2,400 beds over the next decade. And this just gives you sort of a snapshot of the operational costs associated with that if nothing were to change as we move forward. And this gives you the total debt service over 10 years. We pay about $132 to $140 million of debt service a biennium on what's still remaining about a $1.6 billion investment in prison construction debt over the last 15 years or so that the state's continuing to pay on.
Representative Nolan, did you have a question?
I did. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Mr. Williams, you mentioned on an earlier slide an increase of 9,000 prisoners since, I can't remember the date, 1989, I think.
9,000 beds of construction since then.
So that means on top of a 5,000-bed base. Do you have information that compares the rate of growth of either capacity or actual incarceration of other states over the same period? To go from 5,000 to 14,000, that means in the course of 20 years, Oregon nearly trebled our prison capacity and presumably our prisoner population. What have other states done in terms of the rate of growth in the same period?
Co-chairs and Representative Nolan, I think it's important that we be very careful about how we talk about rates of incarceration. Oregon dramatically increased its rate of incarceration from where it was to where it is now. Oregon, as compared to many other states, has a fairly average rate of incarceration. Mr. Prince can tell you where we fit in the 50 states.
I wasn't clear. I'm not talking about the rate of incarceration against the general population. I'm talking about the rate of increase in the prison beds.
Again, co-chairs and Representative Nolan, we did grow dramatically fast in our increasing sort of growth in our population.
Right.
As compared to, now I think there are some other states that probably grew faster than we did. Texas and California both come to mind. Texas sort of hit a tipping point a few years ago where they have adopted some of the kinds of things that I just got done talking about, in part because they hit a point where they didn't believe their trajectory was further sustainable, and they didn't want to build any more prisons. So they started talking about doing their business differently. So there were states that I think that probably grew faster. But I think it's also fair to say, and important to point out, that we went for decades in Oregon with zero investment in while the population grew and the crime rate expanded, we went decades without any investment in corrections. And so much of what you see sort of in the 90s was, I think, an effort by Oregon at some level to also try to get us right-sized at some level, then driven by further policies that sort of hyper-expanded the growth. But if you go back and look at the time, for example, Governor Goldschmidt came on, and you read some of even the inaugural address, you'll see that one of the major problems Oregon was having was there weren't enough prison beds. There were federal orders sort of mandating the maximum number of people you could keep in the couple of prisons that we were really operating, and people were getting sentenced to fairly significant crimes, and as they would walk in the door, you would have to push somebody else out the door. So the parole board was really the exit valve mechanism. It wasn't a good system, I think, by everybody's agreement. And whether or not the sentencing guidelines started to solve that, and then we got Measure 11, and it changed the whole trajectory, I think is a conversation that reasonable people might debate about. But we did grow very fast, and I'm sure we can give you some comparisons as compared to other states about how fast that rate of growth was during that period of time.
Thanks.
Back to this long-term budget slide that you've seen before. The point of this one, I added then the piece here. If you were to, this is just, again, not for your benefit as much as when I've shown this to other groups, Rotary Clubs and Kiwanians and others that I've talked to over the last 6 to 8 months about this. if you took all of the things that were in the governor's reset recommendations, aligning state employee growth, K-12 growth, you continued all the allotment cuts, you included the PERS retiree solution, you eliminated inflation, and you did the kinds of things that we were talking about here, you still see on that bottom line is still your gap. So even with all this effort, gargantuan sort of moves, there's still $1 billion or so of gap based on these recommendations. This was, I think, for me, sort of a message of two parts as I shared this with folks. Message number one was that these are really, really hard things to do, and even if you do all of them, it's not going to solve the problem. And message number two was that even beyond this, you were going to need other really challenging ideas to get to a place that would align our budget for the biennium. The do-nothing options, if you weren't to do anything with respect to corrections in the prison population, which isn't a reality, but if you weren't, and you required a 20% reduction of virtually every other program tied into public safety, this shows you a range of the kinds of reductions that would have to be made in other agencies. A cut of a substantial, almost $100 million out of community corrections, almost $100 million in the state police, and almost $100 million out of the youth authority if they were to take sort of the corrections proportional share of that reduction if you didn't do anything to try to address these issues in a corrections-based budget. So that just gives you some range of what the impacts would be and how this has got to be at some level a shared model. Of course, this is the question I pose to everybody. Nobody likes any of these options, by the way, except if they're in human services or education. And they don't like the options that were in the reset report that were put forward for them. So the question I pose to everybody is, if you don't like these options, what do you propose? What are your best ideas? I always talk about corrections as being sort of three primary dials that impact the overall corrections budget. It's a question of how big do you want the net to be? In other words, who do you want to put in prison? How long do you want them to stay? Those two things really decide the population. And then how much do we want to pay for the people who provide the supervising of the offenders and the providing of the services? And those are the primary drivers of corrections budget. And beyond that, everything is pretty much loose change. And, of course, the clock is ticking. The question I pose at the bottom, are we convinced we've got everything right? Are we using all the best evidence? Have we got the right sentencing structure? Have we applied the right risk tools? Are we targeting our resources on the right offenders? I think in this time, I'm not saying that we don't have it all right. I think there's a lot of things we do have right. But I also think we're at a point in our circumstances where it's fair to ask the question and do the work to figure out whether or not there's some things we could be doing differently that would, again, preserve our public safety, but operate the system in a less expensive and more efficient way. So those were the pieces that were part of the governor's reset report. Again, Mr. Taylor had asked that I come and present them as sort of a kickoff for, I think, what's going to be a session-long conversation with all of you about these policy issues, and I look forward to it at about the same level I'm sure all of you do. I'd be happy to answer any further questions that any of the committee has before I turn it over to Mr. Prince.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Williams.
We got a traveling gavel in case you're not used to it. We don't fight over the gavel. We just pass it back and forth.
Thank you, Mr. Good afternoon. For the record, I'm Craig Prince. I'm the Executive Director of the Criminal Justice Commission, and I have a slideshow that I think dovetails pretty well with what Director Williams said. This is Mike Wilson. He's an economist with my office. And so we're going to, I think, go through some of the things you've mentioned, Representative Hicks mentioned, Representative Nolan, some of the questions that we've hit already. We wanted to talk about what the sentencing structure is today, look at some public perception polling that's been done on public safety. I think it shows what folks really, what citizens really care about as they look at our public safety system and as you look at it. And then there's two things that I wanted Michael mostly to talk about, which are you'll see throughout Director Williams talked about risk, who's a higher risk, risk tools. We wanted to show you a risk tool that my staff has developed along with Max Williams' staff to help do a risk assessment of offenders, and then let Michael talk about a cost-benefit tool that would do some of what I think Representative or Chair Krieger was talking about with trying to figure out what are the savings and avoided costs, really a cost-benefit look at public safety. That's our presentation. Max hit this, Director Williams hit this, the crime rates are at a 40-year low. If that doesn't seem like it feels right, it probably doesn't feel right to the citizens either. That's mostly because they don't get their information from the FBI. They get it from the cable television, which has had a huge expansion of its coverage of crime. It really is, I think, an important dynamic. I have a video that I think presented to several of you in the interim. One expert on communications called it the mean world syndrome, which basically you can see statistically the more television you watch, the worse you expect you expect crime rates to be in, and the less safe you feel. Nonetheless, the FBI Uniform Crime Reports and the National Victimization Survey show that crime, which really rose in the 80s and 90s, has been on a over a decade-long national trend down, and that is for violent and property crime. The good news in Oregon is that we've had some of the biggest drops recently in the last 5 years, and particularly on property crime. Our crime rate has dropped substantially in the last few years, even from when the data was collected for the Measure 57, for example, that was put was a referral from the legislature. The data we were looking at was from 2006 when we put together that and those crime rates, and you can see they've dropped dramatically in the years since then. But that does not mean that citizens feel safe today, because they get their understanding of the world around them from media. This is incarceration trends. Representative Nolan, I think this answers your question. So the U.S., you're right, it tripled since 80. The nation as an average quadrupled. So it is very much accurate to say Oregon is an average incarcerator as far as all 50 states. It is also accurate to say Oregon has tripled. Its use of incarceration as a rate, meaning the number of Oregonians per 1,000, there are three times as many today as there were in 1980. The growth in Oregon, and again, I think Director Williams mentioned this, occurred later. It really occurred in the late 80s and the mid 90s is when our incarceration rate really began to increase. Most of the rest of the U.S. Increased more in the 80s. And as Director Williams said, Measure 73 and the reinstatement of 57 would increase beyond that, and I've got a couple slides to show that. So the blue is the actual beds in use to carry out our current sentencing policy today. The top green would be the October 2010 forecast with Measure 73 added to it. And that is Measure 73 as it would be in a place, the way Director Williams talked about it, where it actually has a presumptive prison sentence. The way that's applied, as Representative Hicks mentioned, from a prosecutor's perspective, it varies very much by how it's applied on a case-by-case basis by the prosecutor. For Measure 73, we asked the Oregon District Attorneys Association in a public hearing, how would you all apply this? And we got back from several counties how they would apply it. Some of the counties said they would send 90% of the offenders who qualified under Measure 73 to prison. Some said 25%. And so it really was applied differently in every county. But we took that application and we put it into the estimates we gave to the Fiscal Estimate Committee. I'm not very good at my colors. I'm not colorblind. I just don't know what you call them. The brown slide would be the October forecast, which would include Measure 57. Representative Wisnett, to answer your question, when the Criminal Justice Commission worked with the Fiscal Estimate Committee in estimating the impact of Measure 57, we estimated it would be about 1,600 beds. And when we got the data from 2009 and we were able to see how it was actually applied by the prosecutors and then model that for the next decade, it looks like about 1,000 beds. So again, that's that difficulty of, I can ask, you know, the dynamic that Representative Hicks talked about with Measure 11 is similar to Measure 57. The difficulty is quantifying it. So I had a lot of conversations like, so can you give me a percentage? What does that mean? What percentage of the guys who qualify for it are going to get a prison sentence? How many of them are going to get a probation sentence? And can you tell me about that? I acknowledge I'm a former prosecutor. That's very hard for a prosecutor to analyze. Prosecutors look at things on a case-by-case basis. So we weren't able to get a percentage going forward. That's why it was 1,600. When we see how it was applied in 2009, if it's applied like that, it'll be about 1,000 beds over the decade. And then the red line is no Measure 57 or Measure 73 impact to the prison forecast. I looked at Governor Kitzhaber's budget for DOC, and I listened in this morning. His budget does assume a suspension of Measure 57 during the biennium of 11-13. And he also mentioned the tweaks to the Measure 73 DYI portion so that it would no longer have a presumptive prison sentence. It would have just a 90-day jail sentence, which would be served in the county and would be paid for by the state with that language that Director Williams mentioned. It says the state shall pay for the actual cost of incarceration. So those lines are kind of what the forecast looks like for the next decade, depending on, you know, which policies that are passed by the legislature, the citizens, etc., are in place. So what drives Oregon's need for prison beds? As you can see, we have so if you look at that, it's about 2,500 additional beds would be needed during the decade of deficit if you look at that October 2010 forecast. And this is really critical, I think. The way I try to describe this is when you, as a legislator, as a representative of your district, look at that forecast, I think for a long time we looked at it as a thermometer. That's just where it is. And that means we have to build the next prison, we have to build Junction City, etc. I've noticed a shift with that in the last, you know, well, basically during the deficit of the revenue deficit. Folks are starting to look at that more as a thermostat. What could we do to change that? And that's really important. Starting question is, you know, do you agree that we need to control this growth or not? That's really a starting point, and that will determine whether you think of that forecast as a thermostat or a thermometer. And then obviously the other question is, how do we do that and maintain public safety? Director Williams also mentioned criminology, and it's actually another presentation. We've done a lot of looks at what really has caused the huge crime reduction that we talked about. It's complicated. No shock there, right? That there's lots of things that cause crime and control crime. Some of them are things that we do intentionally. Some of them are demographics, meaning how many young males do you have in your population. So all those things impact crime. But the important thing is...
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is that 2,500 prison beds meaning... new facilities or currently unused beds in existing facilities?
Oh, good question. Co-chairs, Representative Juan, that would be 2,500 more prisoners in beds than today. So right now we have 14,000 beds in use. There are some beds in the system that are not, you know, not in use. They're mothballed because of to save funding. Some of those are already built. But that would mean we'd have to have 14,000 more prisoners in beds than we have today to carry out our current sentencing structure. And our incarceration rate would increase that much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So this really, I think, again, Director Williams talked about this. Sentencing really lends itself to a short-term and a long-term look because the short-term and long-term answers really are very different. To give you an example, Governor Kitzhaber did mention the Public Safety Commission that Governor Kulongoski started and mentioned that he wanted to go forward with that. That would be the opportunity to really look at public safety in the long term, to look at whether you'd want to incorporate some of the initiatives we talked about, but try to control how they're applied. Again, this gets to Representative Hicks' point. You know, how either the prosecutor or the judge applies the law on an individual case-by-case basis is so critical, and we'd have to look at that. And who decides how you make that decision? What information would be important in that? That would be a long-term decision. For 2011, 2013, this is where the short-term gets different, and I want to make a point on that. In 2011-13, this is obvious, but it bears stating, a two-year sentence costs the same as a 25-year sentence or a 10-year sentence in 11-13. Now, that's not completely true because some of them would be minimum security, some of them would be medium security, some of them would be high security, so on a marginal basis. But really, you can say that because obviously only 2 years of it will be carried out during the biennium. When you look at the intakes to prison, there's about 4,300. People go to prison, they go into the front door through Coffee Creek facility in Wilsonville, and then they are dispersed through Director Williams's Department of Corrections system that he is the director of. About 2,000 of those are nonviolent, and I put quotations around that. It's important that we understand the definitions, but meaning they were certainly not person crimes, and we would look at the ones that are on the edge of that to make sure we all agree what nonviolent means. And that's really, for 11-13, the question is which folks can be safely managed in a county, in a jail. Is there a jail? Is there a jail that is got a jailer to run it? Really those type of dynamics and the incentives and how you build that front end of the system is so important for 11-13. And, of course, you're balancing multiple goals of sentencing. We always talk about public safety. Public safety, I think, is paramount. It's the number one issue. We can't forget about accountability. Accountability is just as important in sentencing, and that would be, from your perspective, the left-hand ledger, you know, personal responsibility for a crime, and it's really paying for the crime that you already did is so important, as is, you know, building a system that keeps us safe as we move forward. So I think, again, Director Williams hit some of these things. I'm just going to hit them very briefly. I think you know this. We didn't have sentencing guidelines until 1989. Before sentencing guidelines, the parole board and the judge were kind of the key discretionary points. But it's almost unfair to say that. The biggest thing that drove it was we didn't have very many prison beds back then. And so really what happened is there was a lot of release to parole. So the sentence would be served in the community when the offender was paroled. And that dynamic really persisted through the 80s when there were three measures to allow bonding to build more correctional facilities. They all failed. The citizens did not pass those. And there was a decree in place from a district court that was then vacated on appeal called Capps versus Atiyah that really said we were, one district court federal judge decided we were in violation of the Eighth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, cruel and unusual. That was overturned. But we were really in a prison crowding then, and then the guidelines then were built basically on that capacity. There was kind of an acceptance that we can grow some, but really, you know, this is really the capacity we have, and we need to control to it, and we need to make sure that we have accountability and truth in sentencing with what we've got. And that's when the guidelines were built in 1989, and I kind of call that legislative control of the situation. Really, that changed in 1994 with Measure 11 and then Measure 57 and then Measure 73, and we've got other measures that didn't make it, but we had a kind of a negotiation about. I think the upshot of that has been, again, what Representative Hicks is, it shifted the control over the individual case decision to the district attorney. There's no guidelines to that. You know, the guidelines, which are elaborately legalized by a bunch of lawyers, have been so minutiaed as to what can make the sentence go up and down, back and forth. The DA discretion is not so guided by law, but it's still important nonetheless. So why do I... This is probably the most important slide for you to understand, I think, for 1113. This is the top 20 ways to go to prison in Oregon. So Burg 1 would be the burglary, the entering of a dwelling place to commit a crime. That is the most common way to go to prison. It's not the longest, it's not the biggest months imposed, but it's the most common way to get to Coffee Creek Correctional Facility. If you look at these, burglary 1 is impacted by Measure 57, if it comes back or not. Theft 1 is impacted by Measure 57. That's the second most common. Delivery of meth is somewhat impacted by Measure 57. Identity theft is. Unauthorized use of a motor vehicle is. As you go through these, robbery in the second degree, which would be a robbery where you're purporting to have a deadly or dangerous weapon, but you don't, usually. My point in giving you this is, if you look at those top 20, you'll see most of these, two-thirds of these sentencing intakes are impacted by one of the voter initiatives. In other words, you can't really talk about controlling this thing very easily and just stay talking about the guidelines anymore. If you did, you would be looking at assault 4 as a C felony, which is a domestic violence assault, which your experts on that will say that's a good indicator of future lethality on domestic violence, and that domestic violence, and sadly, is not one of the areas where we've seen dramatic reductions in Oregon. Felon in possession of a weapon and use of a weapon. So this is the news, is that really the intakes at this point in 2011 are really controlled to some degree as to which citizen initiatives are in place. When you look at then the total impact of the months that are imposed, because the Measure 11 sentences and the Measure 11 plea down sentences that Representative Hicks mentioned are the longer sentences, they then impact over about two-thirds, of the total forecast is Measure 11 impact. That doesn't mean Measure 11 is completely that, because those guys mostly went to prison before Measure 11, but that's what impacts the total forecast. So that's kind of the long-term look at this thing, and it's complicated. It's become complicated over the years, but that's kind of where we are today. So some of the critical questions, and I think these are more things that I would say for a longer look, a bigger look, or the Public Safety Commission that Governor Kitzhaber endorsed today, is really those seminal questions. Again, which actor in the criminal justice system is best situated to apply sentencing law in the individual case, the judge or the prosecutor? Should it be a party opponent or a judge who really is evaluating the offense, again, the pencil in the arm, looking at the offender with hopefully with a risk tool we could talk about that would inform that decision? And most importantly, probably, is the impact to the victim. You know, was there a victim that was injured, seriously injured, killed? Was it a property offense? All those things are so important. 22 states and the federal system mostly work on a guideline system. They have some mandatory minimums in place, but most of the sentencing is in that type of structure, and that was decided in those situations where that's the best balance of legislature giving the basic guidance, the executive branch prosecuting the case, bringing the case, and then the judicial power, the neutral party, looking at it on a case-by-case basis and then saying, what should we do in this individual case? Part of what we had talked about with the reset is looking forward, that our modern sentencing guidelines could be more public safety focused, meaning we could guide the guidelines in the future with the 20 years of corrections research and criminology we've built up since Oregon's guidelines were done in 1989. A move to a guidelines would be a move back to a neutral judicial officer making the individual sentencing cases, decisions, a judge would be doing that. and we would be looking at using some of those 9,000 beds that have been built since 1989, and we would give guidance to that decision. Again, that whole decision, so what do I do in this situation? We would have guidance. You'd look at what would be considered an aggravating factor to make the sentence longer, what's a mitigating factor, what does this offender pose as a public safety risk? So that's really what we had looked at with the reset committee, and then that's the kind of the look that was contemplated in the Governor Kulongoski's Public Safety Commission, and then was what I believe Governor Kitzhaber was mentioning this morning in his budget brief. So very fascinating look at, you know, when you look at 2011 with the economy and look at what's going on with sentencing reform. Director Williams mentioned Texas, Kansas, a lot of states are looking at really reforming their system. And it's very interesting to look at citizen views of corrections and corrections reform. The Pew Center did a study with the public, an outfit called the Public Opinion Strategy, where they did 1,200 registered voters. This is nationwide. This is not just in Oregon. I'm just giving you this because I think it's fascinating to look at how some of these have changed. And they pose different questions to the citizens that they contacted. And, you know, I said that there is public safety and accountability in sentencing and the corrections, but it was very clear that public safety is really what citizens care about. And they want a strong public safety system where criminals are held accountable and there are consequences. And they also believe that a strong public safety system like that is possible while reducing the size and cost of the prison system. We started looking, this firm looked at this and noticed the way they framed these. They started talking about, and I want you to highlight these, and Director Williams mentioned this too, what if you reduce prison time for a low-risk offender who's nonviolent so that the state funding can be used to keep violent criminals in prison for their full sentence? You can see strongly favor 58%, 87% in total favor. And then the second one, when asked, these 1,200 citizens across the country asked, what if we reduce prison time for, again, low-risk, nonviolent offenders, and here's a key word, reinvest some of the savings to create a stronger probation and parole system that holds offenders accountable for their crimes? We think we can. These are important ways to frame this because it really gets down to the question of you want public safety and you want it informed like a business, and you want this thing to be based on business-like decisions about what will keep you safe. This is also an interesting one. They asked, do you agree or disagree with this statement? It doesn't matter whether a nonviolent offender is in prison for 21 months or 24 months or 27 months. What really matters is the system does a better job, again, of making sure that when an offender does get out, he's likely less likely to commit another crime. I think this is what Representative Krieger was pointing out. One of the real concerns as our unemployment rates are higher in Oregon is obviously the likelihood of a convicted felon to be employed is much more difficult. So I just hit a couple of those more. The citizens here said prison is a government program, and just like any other government program, they need to be put to the cost-benefit test. So again, they keep coming back to, if you frame it as looking at like a business or a cost-benefit analysis of this, there's an agreement with that. If you're talking about low-risk offenders, for example, and you're talking about making the rest of the system safer. So that's what seems to resonate with voters. They want a strong public safety system. That's their number one goal. Identifying low-risk offenders then is important. And then this is a big one, reinvesting some of the savings from that criminal justice, from that correction sentence that's more expensive to another one. They want to use cost-benefit analysis to really test where's the best place to do that. And so the question that would then be, what are the tools we need to identify low-risk offenders and interventions with the highest rate of return? So the Criminal Justice Commission has developed, and I think it's important, this is something I'm passionate about and I've worked on for 5 years. We have now developed a web-based risk tool that allows a prosecutor, a judge, or a defender to to put in a state ID for any offender who has at least one felony conviction. So we have enough information. We look at their arrest record. We look at their probation violation record. We look at whether they've been incarcerated or not. We look at their age and all those factors, and we can develop a likelihood that whether or not they'll be whether they'll recidivate. We measure it by conviction for any felony, arrest for any person crime, arrest for any property crime. And we think this is an important tool to try to give to the decision makers in the system. It provides an objective, validated look at the probabilities whether an offender will recidivate, and it's based upon data that I don't think would be of any surprise to Representative Hicks or anyone else. It's nothing other than their criminal history data looked at in a different way, and then using an equation to actually have an analysis to be able to develop what that means.
Your representative told me.
Thank you. This is a little bit off the topic.
Sorry.
When you were talking about accountability and people taking personal responsibility and talking about victim rights and consequences, talk some about restorative justice, because I think that's a concern that the public does have. Just putting somebody, incarcerate them for months, years, how does that help the victim?
Right.
How,
Representative Krieger and Representative Tomei, Arwen Bird's here, and she could speak much more eloquently than I could about impact to victims and restorative justice. And I would encourage you to have her come at some time and speak to you. All I can look at it is more from a quantitative data guy look at it, and it's clear on the polling of the public. Obviously, restitution was one of the most important things that really voters wanted to see out of the criminal justice system. And there has been a lot of work in the area of restorative justice that the data shows it is does impact both the victim positively and the offender. I am not an expert on it, and with someone who is an expert in the room, I just feel, you know, she'd probably be a better to speak to that. So I hope that's sufficient.
Yeah,
and I can,
that's great. Thank you. Yeah. And I hope someday, we probably won't have time today, but I hope at some point we do hear from Ms. Bird.
Representative Hicks.
Yeah, and the portion about sort of what the public wants and expects, to my eye, this kind of goes to the dilemma of Measure 57, which was very highly, you know, it increased the amount of time assigned to Department of Corrections, but it was also a lot of emphasis on rehabilitation programs. And so, I mean, that's what the public wants.
That's
and so this is kind of the dilemma. In the short term, we're going to, you know, if it was suspended pretty early, the fact that it passed overwhelmingly by the voters, notwithstanding, it was suspended, and to save money, but I regret that it wasn't in place long enough for us to really examine whether that ultimately did save money or whether it could have saved money through the rehabilitation approach that it took. So, I mean, it didn't surprise me at all that Measure 57 passed. I mean, especially in light of the data that you just provided. I mean, it seems to make sense that when people rehabilitate, they're not going to commit crimes anymore, and that was what the voters wanted. And so, I mean, that's going to be, I think, something that we get to reexamine along the course of this session as well. But it sounds like there really is no way to put a number on how much that could have saved. I mean,
I think the difficult part of that, of course, is property crime dropped very substantially without Measure 57 being in place. Even from when we were starting to analyze it to prepare for it, you know, we were looking at 2006 data from the Uniform Crime Reports, and it started to drop without it being in place. But I think you've hit on a really critical question, which is the voters want to be safe. That's what they're saying. And it depends on what questions put before them. They're going to say, yes, I want longer sentences to be safe. Yes, I want rehabilitation to be safe. The point is, I think, you know, how do you develop a system around public safety? And I think that has to be informed by the evidence of what works so that we're working like a business. It's very difficult to distill that down to a voter's pamphlet, a voter's slogan even. And that's what I think is the difficulty of doing sentencing by initiative process. Mm. So I think you've hit on a really important one that's hard to, but I think it's an important conversation. And I agree. I take away from that all of these things are saying we want public safety. Public safety is important to us. The question is, of course, what's the best way to provide that? And a lot of times what the evidence is saying and what makes for a really good I hate, I, you know, a short-term slogan are really not the same thing. So it's a great point. The risk tool, I just wanted to make it abundantly clear. The risk tool factors into protection of society and reformation. It does not tell you how to hold an offender accountable. So, for example, if someone murdered his wife, and the data would show you, by the way, it's very unlikely that that person would ever murder again, the risk tool doesn't tell you how he should be held accountable. Obviously, he should pay for his crime, and that's the principles that go to personal responsibility and accountability for one's actions. The risk tool only informs one side of the principles of public safety versus accountability, and I would never, never, never want someone to say, well, the risk tool would say, let these guys out because they're low risk and it doesn't matter. Someone has to take all of that evidence, all of the data, look at the offender, look at the victim, and put it all into one decision. And that's the critical decision that we've been talking about. That's what sentencing is bringing all that together. But it does provide you really detailed information. The risk tool, again, the criminal justice, the sentencing guidelines on burglary, for example, burglary is at level 7 if it's an unoccupied dwelling. If it's an occupied dwelling, it's level 8. If it's an occupied dwelling where you're trying to cause physical injury, it can be a level 9. That is a way that lawyers and judges think about how accountable, how culpable is the person. And we have made an elaborate system of how to do that. We have mitigating factors. We say, well, if the offender played a minor or passive role, he's less culpable. If he was doing this deliberately for cruelty, he's more culpable. You should make his sentence longer or shorter. The point is, we don't have anything like that for public safety risk. What's the likelihood that this person in the future is going to commit another crime? That's what the risk tool does. So the guidelines and the way lawyers think of it on accountability, we hope that we can start to inform with data-driven decisions. A burglar is not a burglar. We don't treat a burglar in the guidelines all the same. We look at, did they enter my house to try to, you know, again, was it a domestic violence thing where someone knocked the door down and was trying to, you know, assault someone? Or was it a deal where a guy went onto my screen porch, which is part of my residence, and stole a six-pack of beer? Was he 18 for burglar one? You have to be 18 years of age to be held criminally responsible. Was he 18 on a bicycle? Was he a 45-year-old multiple-time convicted felon? That's the kind of thing that the risk tool brings to the public safety side, as well as to complement what the guidelines would do on the accountability side.
Krieger, a couple of things. Maybe I missed it when I was out, but the cost of incarceration at the county level versus in the state prison system, you talked about using that. What's the difference in the cost, or does it vary quite a bit?
Yeah, Representative Co-Chair Krieger, it varies a lot. And that there, as you know, that'll touch off a conversation like nothing. You know, looking at, it's different in every county, first of all. I think there are efficiencies in the prison system, meaning Director Williams is feeding 14,000 guys, so I think in a lot of situations his meal cost might be different, the labor cost is different, all of those things. And then important too, again, to use Josephine County as an example, when Representative Hicks said they don't have that many jail beds, the jailer, the sheriff in Josephine County has a release authority that they can release out people that Director Williams doesn't. So all of those factors make it difficult. I know you know that that's a firestorm type discussion, but one we need to have. What's the cost at the state? What's the cost in the county? What are the flexibilities as far as electronic monitoring in the county that could take care of low-risk offenders, things like that? It's a great discussion.
I'll have an easy one for you.
Oh, thank you.
Under Measure 11, what was the mental criteria to say that 76 months was the proper time for that was adequate for penalty, mm-hmm. was adequate to reduce recidivism, mm-hmm. training, maybe recovery programs. But what if, instead of 76 months for that crime, 46 months or 40 months did exactly the same thing? Yeah. Have we ever looked at that?
Co-Chair Krieger, we have started to really look at Measure 11, how it's applied. I mean, I can answer you just from the... So I was not the chief petitioner of Measure 11, and I was... I think I was in college when it was passed, so I don't know what was in folks' mind. So that wasn't an easy question, by the way. I don't know what was in the mind of the chief petitioner, the voter. What I can tell you is what was in the voter's pamphlet was that 70 months or 90 months, the crime set on the 16 crimes that were originally in Measure 11 is that it was the minimum required for justice to the society and the victim. Now, when you look at how Measure 11's applied, you can say only 29% of the offenders are actually convicted of that most serious offense. The big majority are actually dealt with a lesser sentence. So even if it was that is the minimum required for justice in society and that was the intent, that's really not how it's applied on a case-by-case basis.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Garrett.
It's kind of a related question on Measure 11 and cost-benefit. I remember last fall there was a piece in the Oregonian by, I think, John Saponia with Echo Northwest, in which he put he very specifically quantified the diminished returns in investment on Measure 11. I think he had, for every dollar that we put in at the beginning of Measure 11, we got back somewhere between $2 and $3 in savings. And now that figure is down to 91 cents or something. So we're actually losing money for every marginal dollar that we now put into Measure 11. Is that the kind of work you're doing? I mean, can you comment on that study? I don't know, you know.
Co-chairs and Representative Garrett, co-vice chair Garrett, I'm the first one to try that out. I think
Thank
I
you.
Got it right. Okay. Co-vice chair Garrett. That study that John Tapani and Echo Northwest did was a study of incarceration. So not just Measure 11, but just what's the effect of incarceration. This guy here to my right was the one that did that study based upon William Spellman's work out of the University of Texas. And yes, we have done that, and we've modeled that, and we've looked at the effect of incarceration as a whole. The number you're speaking to is if you look at, you know, any offender, you know, in it. And so the key is it avoids more crime if you are locking up, high risk to, you know, to violently reoffend. And that's why risk is important for anything. So, but Michael did that work and has worked with that, and we could do a whole presentation on the diminishing marginal returns of incarceration, if you'd like.
That'd be great.
I think I'll hand it off to Michael Wilson, our economist, to talk about why it's kind of a good segue, why risk is important.
Co-chairs and members of the committee, I'm Mike Wilson. I also work at the Criminal Justice Commission. And I was just going to spend some time here at the end going over sort of two examples that, in my mind anyway, make a lot of sense of kind of what we've talked about and a lot of the questions that you all are going to be asked. What are some sort of tools that we can use to answer some of these questions that hopefully can provide you with some information to make the tough decisions that will come this session. So the first example, we want to look at using this risk tool, and instead of looking at individual and, you know, typing individual names, look at it sort of globally over a group of offenders. And this is just an illustration of a way we could do that. But we looked at 3 years' worth of property offenders, and we looked at those that went to prison and those that didn't, and compared the risk. And so we can see that depending on where you put offenders, so if you have high-risk offenders, you're going to see in prison there's going to be some high-risk offenders, some low-risk offenders. On probation, you have the same thing, some high-risk offenders, some low-risk offenders. If we can switch those out so that the low-risk offenders that are in prison, we can put on probation. The high-risk offenders that are on probation, we can put in prison. We can realize a savings to the number of prison beds we need and a reduction in crime. And so this is just a graphical representation of that, where you can see the graph on the left is offenders on probation by risk, and the line to the right, the reddish-colored line, are offenders in prison by risk. So the good news as you look at that is you can see that that to some extent we're putting the right people in prison, the right people on probation. Again, these are a group of just property offenders. So we can see that the property offenders that are incarcerated are higher risk on average than those that get probation, which is a good thing. But we can also see there's some overlap there. We can see there's some low-risk people that got prison sentences, and there's some high-risk people that got probationers. So the question is, if we swap those out, we move those around based on risk, and again, these are similar type of offenders. These aren't the violent offenses. These are all property offenders with sentences. I can't remember the cutoff, but lower sentences, maybe 18 months or lower. So we didn't get the ones, you know, the stacked ID thefts that were maybe in prison for 10 years. We took those out of the equation here. And we're just looking at similar types of offenders. And this is the type of impact we could have with just this small group of people. We could switch out. If we look at the low-risk probationers, there's about 780 of them that we could switch out with the low-risk prisoners, we could switch out with the high-risk probationers. And we see in doing this, we can avoid 229 prison beds over this time period while also reducing the number of arrests. So it's not changing. It's actually having a slight improvement on public safety because we're seeing fewer crimes as a result of this. And it also avoids a number of prison beds because we've taken those that are more likely to commit crimes, instead of keeping them in the community, we put those offenders in prison, and taking those that are less likely to commit crimes that got a prison sentence and putting them on probation. In doing that, we're able to save both prison beds and avoid crime in the community. So this is a really good application of risk. And when we're thinking about different sentencing changes, we can think of, you know, not just whole scale saying something's probation or prison, but we can look at risk where we can not have as negative impact on public safety if we put the higher risk guys in prison, lower risk offenders on probation. So the second...
You're talking about property... Nonviolent.
Yeah, this is an example here. All nonviolent offenders, all property offenders with similar lengths of sentences. So we've taken out the person that's been stealing IDs for the last 5 years and gets a 120 month sentence. We drop those offenders out.
And just a reminder for new people on the committee: Measure 11 only applies to violent person-to-person crimes.
So yeah, this would be primarily RPO or Major 57 type of offenders.
Yeah, thank you.
So a second kind of example I want to go through is what I've spent a lot of time the last few years working at the Criminal Justice Commission is working with cost-benefit and developing a cost-benefit model for Oregon. And really the big question is, what's the soundest investment of our taxpayer dollars? The question that you all are asked all the time. And we've done the analysis that Craig spoke of earlier. I'm looking at prisons and what impact prisons have on crime. And we found that, along with other research, that prison does have an impact on reducing crime. We see that as we lock offenders up, there's incapacitation effect there, and there's fewer crimes as a result of that. Prisons also have the point of just deserves, the purpose in sentencing of giving an offender what they deserve, which certainly is a point of prisons that, when we're looking at cost-benefit and public safety or and the risk tool, doesn't really answer that question. We're looking more at risk to recidivism. But we can see that prisons do have certain outcomes, and the downside is that they're expensive, right? We have $84 a day for prisons, possibly less depending on if it's a temporary bed. But prisons are expensive compared to other options. So another way we can invest our money, or you all can invest the money, is policymakers by looking at programs. So are there programs out there that can change the behavior of criminals? So the idea with prisons is majority of the offenders, 93% of them, are going to get out and they're going to leave prison. And if there's nothing done to modify that behavior while they're in prison, the only real benefit the time that they're in there is the crime they aren't committing while they're there, and then to some extent, as they age, they're going to be less likely to commit crimes. But if we don't do anything to modify or change that behavior, we're going to see more crime when we get out and have an expensive criminal justice system as we continue to roll through that. So we can look at programs, and the difficulty with programs is that it's hard to determine. You have a guy locked up in prison, that guy's not going to commit any crimes outside of prison. People in programs, some of those people are going to commit crimes. And it isn't always straightforward to figure out if your program is effective or not. You have to figure out if you have a good control group and then you really need researchers to be able to look into this to make sure that program is actually effective. So there's some benefits to prisons and some costs, obviously, and benefits and costs to programs as well. So when we look at cost-benefit program, or cost-benefit analysis, this moves beyond the idea of just cutting costs. It's talking about how can we really get the best bang for our dollar? How can we invest our money, sort of like you think of as a business? We're going to invest our money. What are the ways we can invest to get the best return of our money? So as a business, you're thinking about profits. As a policymaker, you're wanting to think of how can you best invest limited tax dollars to get the best public safety outcome. In this case, reduced crime is really what we're looking at. So the idea is to put this sort of analysis in a way that makes sense to all of you, that we can say if we invest X number of dollars in this type of program, we can expect to see this type of return on the other end. So to put things in sort of a dollars and cents framework. So this is really a pressing question as we're looking at, you know, declining state budgets, and we're going to have to see different options of how do we decrease the prison population to save money in the public safety budget. And as we do that, as we think of options that we can reduce the prison population, if it's delays to Measure 57 or changing Measure 73 or different recommendations in the reset report, you're going to see benefits, obviously, to taxpayers. As we don't use a prison bed, there's a direct benefit to taxpayers of less people in prison. There's a savings there. There's also a cost of that we need to acknowledge as well. If we're letting people out of prison early, or if we're not sending certain offenders to prison, there's going to be a cost to that policy of some amount of increased crime. So when we look at a cost-benefit tool, we can begin to think about reinvesting some of that money into evidence-based programs that we think reduce recidivism, and there's possibly outcomes where we can do both reduce the amount of spending that you all allocate to public safety while continuing to maintain the low crime rates we've experienced over the last decade. So it really comes to the question, are there programs that are effective at reducing crime? And the research would say absolutely yes, there are. Washington State Institute of Public Policy is really well known in this area. They've researched almost 600 different studies, and they've read through these studies to say, on average, which programs do we have enough evidence to say that these programs are effective at reducing crime? So they've put together what's called a meta-analysis, looking at all of these studies and figuring out what actually works. In Oregon, we've really begun in the last few years to do more in-state evaluations as well. The Department of Corrections is beginning to automate some of their program evaluation. The Youth Authority is doing the same. We've just worked with NPC, those drug court evaluations in Oregon. They're in Oregon, but they do not the drug court evaluations around the nation. But they've done a statewide drug court evaluation of the drug court funding in Oregon with favorable results as well. So we're beginning to do in-state evaluations as well. So the point is that we know a lot now of what works when we look at programs. We've done in-state evaluations. We can look at literature that says these types of programs work. And we can begin to apply this cost-benefit analysis. You know, how much does it cost offenders to move through the system? So if we intervene to prevent future crime, then we can quantify the potential taxpayer savings and the potential savings to victims as a result of these programs. So I want to give you just a quick screenshot of the next slide of what we call the WISIP tool. The Washington State Institute of Public Policy has developed a tool. They're really the leaders in the nation on cost-benefit work. And we've been asked, we work with Pew and with the Vera Institute on this cost-benefit work. We're really kind of, I guess, second behind Washington as a state in moving ahead on cost-benefit analysis. So,
Briefly, is there enough data available regarding Measure 57 specifically as to whether there was or could have been an end taxpayer benefit despite the initial investment up front because of the rehabilitation programs that were emphasized?
Yeah. Co-chairs, Representative Hicks, we can model that, I guess, theoretically we can model that. We can model how much money was invested in what types of programs and what type of return we expect to get on those programs based on in-state evaluations that we've done in the past and literature reviews. So, yes, we could model that. There hasn't been enough time for the money that's been invested in those programs to do a recidivism study to follow up how much did that actually avoid? We haven't had enough time to do that, but...
I'm sorry, you're saying your office hasn't had enough time, or there wasn't enough time?
There hasn't been enough time. The money has been invested for, I mean, what was it, 2000?
Yeah, I think co-chairs and Representative Hicks, meaning the recidivism, we usually want to let them be in the community for two to three years, have a longitudinal study to see how long they've been out, and so we haven't enough time to let the offenders recidivate or not recidivate.
Okay. So,
we could also, I mean, it also can be modeled, and I'll show you in the next slide, but we have a tool to model this saying that if we bought, you know, 500 slots into drug and alcohol treatment, what we would expect that to avoid in crime, and we can model what the taxpayer savings would be as a result of that. And that's, in theory, that it was like previous research shows or previous studies we've had in the state.
Okay, thanks.
Let me move on to the Washington tool. We're really the first state to be able to begin to test this, and they're rolling this out in a number of different states. And Oregon's, like I said, we're the first state to test it, and we've begun to put all the data in that we need to do sort of a cost-benefit analysis of these different types of programs and sentencing changes. So let me warn you as I turn this slide, there's a lot of information going on here. It's going to be hard to digest it all kind of in one sitting, but I want to point out to you sort of three parts of this model. And the top portion looks at what we call an elasticity of prisons and crime. So we can see that when we either let people out of prison or we send more people to prison, there's an impact on crime as a result of that. So we send more people to prison, we would expect to see a change in the crime rate. If we let people out early or send fewer people to prison, we would see a change in the crime rate in the other direction. So this model acknowledges that any sentencing changes that we make where we have fewer people in prison or more people in prison is going to have an impact on the crime rate. The second section, the middle section we have there, shows call it sort of a portfolio of different programs that we can invest in. These are programs that have evidence that they do reduce recidivism, either from an in-state evaluation or there's research around the country that looks at these programs and says these programs are effective at reducing recidivism. So these are different programs that we can tell the model that we want to invest certain amount of funds in these programs. Now the model will then go through and say, okay, we know that the one that's highlighted there is education in prison. So we know that education in prison reduces recidivism by 10%, let's say. I can't quite read the numbers from here. Let's say it reduces recidivism by 10%. We can go through and we can figure out, on average, what crimes are avoided, and we can estimate the dollar savings to taxpayers and to victims as a result of those fewer crimes. So that allows the policymaker to choose which of these different programs we want to invest in. And then the bottom portion is sort of the kind of the payoff of this model. It says what's the overall avoided cost as a result of this decision we've made. And then on the other side, we can also say what is the estimated impact on victimizations as a result of this. So in this case, you know, in the example we have here, that 133, the red number sort of up in the right upper side, is a sentencing change that says we have 133 fewer people in prison. Now, if we look down on the bottom left side, there's a number there that's 200. That means as a result of letting 133 people out of prison, we would expect to see around 200 more crimes. Now, in this scenario, we invested some of that money back in evidence-based programs, which the bottom number there, which is 586, which resulted in 586 fewer crimes. So on average, this investment portfolio that we chose here saves the state money because we're having fewer people in prison. It also saves crime victims, also saves victimizations because we've invested in programs that we believe will reduce crime.
And we're going to need to wrap it up real quick.
Yeah, and this is really the last slide. I just want to give you guys the idea of what we can do here with just cost-benefit analysis and kind of level of detail we can get at some of the decisions that you all are going to have to make.
Okay, and one thing I'd like to see is some kind of a system, why we're not out ahead of this, maybe in the high schools or some of the other places, so that people aren't committing crimes in the first place. Because one of the, we always talk about the prison costs are driving crime. Crime is driving the prison costs.
Right.
And
that's right.
I mean, we're catching people and trying to do some rehabilitation, which is great, and we should do that. But it'd be really good if we could get them not to.
Yeah, Chair Bargett, a lot of these investments, I agree, are in prevention. So they're in early childhood and juvenile, and those places where you can avoid the crime in the first place.
Sorry, Mr. Taylor. I devoted you there.
No comment. Representative Prince, excuse me, Mr. Prince, you and I have talked a little bit about having a gentleman talk about the research that's been done on scientific policing.
Yes.
Could you give us a little bit of background on that?
Yeah.
We need to wrap up, though. Okay. There's other people that have committees. We have 2 minutes.
Yeah, Council, just to say, they're great speakers on one prevention area we could invest in would be policing. That's really where most of the criminologists are saying is one of the best returns on investment. I'd be more than happy to do that.
Thank you very much. Anything further, committee? Meeting adjourned.